Hi all. The following interview was forwarded to HPR by Brad Carter. Roxy did a live interview with Cap'n Crunch on Cacti Radio a little over a month ago. Before playing the show, I'd like to read you some extracts from Cap'n Crunch's Wikipedia article to give you some context, if you are not familiar with him. This is going to be a long episode, so here we go. From Wikipedia, the free encyclopedia available under the Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike license. John Thomas Draper, born 1943, also known as Captain Crunch, Crunch, or Crunchman, after Cap'n Crunch, the mascot of a breakfast cereal, is a computer programmer and former phone freak. He is a legendary figure within the computer programming world. Draper was the son of a U.S. Air Force engineer. He described his father as distant in an interview published on the front page of the Jan 13, 4, 2007 issue of the Wall Street Journal. Draper himself entered the Air Force in 1964, and, while stationed in Alaska, helped his fellow servicemen make free phone calls home by devising access to a local telephone switchboard. He was honorably discharged from the Air Force in 1968, and did military-related work for several employers in the San Francisco Bay Area. He adopted the counterculture of the times, and operated a pirate radio station out of a Volkswagen van. Heading: Freaking. While Draper was driving around his Volkswagen Microbus to test a pirate radio transmitter, he broadcast a telephone number to listeners as feedback to gauge his station's reception. A callback from a Benny, identified in the Discovery Channel documentary about hacking as Benny Turisi, resulted in a meeting with the blind kids and caused him to blunder into the world of the phone freaks. They wanted him to build a multi-frequency tone generator, the Blue Box, to gain easier entry into the AT&T system, which was controlled by tones. Then they would not have to use an organ and cassette recordings of tones to get free calls. At least one of the blind boys had perfect pitch and had identified the exact frequencies. They informed him that a toy whistle that was, at the time, packaged in boxes of Cap'n Crunch cereal could emit a tone at precisely 2600 Hz, the same frequency that was used by AT&T long lines to indicate that a trunk line was ready and available to route a new call. This would effectively disconnect one end of the trunk, allowing the still connected side to enter an operator mode. Experimenting with this whistle inspired Draper to build Blue Boxes, electronic devices capable of reproducing other tones used by the phone company. The class of vulnerabilities Draper and others discovered was limited to call routing switches not employed in band signaling, whereas newer equipment relies almost exclusively on out-of-band signaling, the use of separate circuits to transmit voice and signals. Though they could no longer serve practical use, the Cap'n Crunch whistles did become valued collector's items. Some hackers sometimes go by the handle Captain Crunch, even today. 2600. The Hacker Quarterly is named after this whistle frequency. The expense of sustaining the unbilled phone calls, the redesign of the line protocols, and the accelerated equipment replacement due to the Blue Box is difficult to calculate, or even to separate from something as complex and dynamic as the telephone long-distance network. The 1971 Esquire article, which told the world about phone freaking, got Draper in hot water. Draper was arrested on toll fraud charges in 1972, and sentenced to 5 years probation. The article also brought him to the attention of Steve Wozniak, who located Draper while working as an engineer at KKUP, a Cupertino public radio station located near the future Apple campus. In the mid-1970s, he taught his phone phreaking skills to Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, who later founded Apple Computer. He was briefly employed at Apple, and created a telephone interface board for the Apple II personal computer. Wozniak has said the reason the board was never marketed was that Wozniak was the only one in the company who liked Draper, and partially due to Draper's arrest and conviction for wire fraud. While at Apple, Draper also wrote a cross-assembler used by Steve Wozniak while developing Apple I and Apple II. Heading: Software Developer. Draper wrote EasyWriter, the first word processor for the Apple II, in 1979. According to the Wall Street Journal, he handwrote the code while serving nights in the Alameda County Jail, then entered the code later into a computer. Draper's personal website furnishes a more detailed version of the coding of EasyWriter. Draper was in prison, in California, at the time, but under a work furlough program. This meant that, while he had to spend every night in prison, he spent each day working a regular job outside prison. This job was at Receiving Studios, a small band practice studio, and, while there he had access to a computer, where he coded EasyWriter. He did take copies of the code home to prison overnight to work on it. Draper later ported EasyWriter to the IBM PC, beating Bill Gates on the bid for the IBM contract. Draper's company, Capon Software, posted less than $1 million revenue over 6 years, and he subsequently sued his software's distributor, Bill Baker, over an unauthorized version of EasyWriter that Baker released without Draper's permission. They settled out of court. Draper's OCD-like behavior and incredibly creative mind has at times led to difficulties with potential clients, who find him too encompassing of the original California software community ethos, which he sticks to until this very day. Shortly after Apple released Macintosh, he taught an online course in Mac programming. Currently he writes computer security software, is a senior developer of CanTalk! Exclamation, VoIP client built around singer and actress Candice Melonarcos, and hosts an internet TV show, Crunch TV. Skipping ahead to the heading: Legends. One oft-repeated story featuring Captain Crunch goes as follows. Draper picked up a public phone, then proceeded to freak his call around the world. At no charge, he routed a call through different phone switches in countries such as Japan, Russia, and England. Once he had set the call to go through dozens of countries, he dialed the number of the public phone next to him. A few minutes later, the phone next to him rang. Draper spoke into the first phone, and, after quite a few seconds, he heard his own voice very faintly on the other phone. Draper also claimed that he and a friend once managed to place a direct call to the White House and spoke directly with someone who sounded like Richard Nixon. Draper's friend told the man about a toilet paper shortage in Los Angeles. Draper was also a member of the Homebrew Computer Club. Hack This Movie. The upcoming documentary Hack This Movie, which features John Draper, is a film being created using a modified open source model for creation and distribution. Inspirations for the model are Kickstarter, the GNU Project, The Age of Stupid, and Sita Sings the Blues. The film is being crowdsourced for individual contributions of art, time, energy, money, and thought. Heading: Current Medical Situation. According to SavingCaptainCrunch.com, Draper has developed trapped nerve syndrome, which, if not alleviated, could potentially cost Draper the use of his arms, hands, and fingers. Draper has been known to neglect his personal health for decades. but the website was created by Sanjeev Bhattacharya, and iMedia Candidate Rally the Hacker Community, or just friends, to donate $10,000 to help pay for the surgery that took place on December 21, 2010. It extensively details the surgical procedure, has historical photos from different periods in Draper's history, includes a blog by Draper discussing his suffering prior to surgery, and a means for donors to converse with Draper directly. Linking to this site is a half-hour-long webcam interview with Draper in the online IPT series The Authness, Episode 3, posted January 6, 2011. It includes an explanation of the donation website, and future uses of the site. According an update he made on his personal Facebook page last March 6, 2011, John still needs 6-8 months of physical therapy in order to get back to normal functionality, and it's a very big financial drain he can't afford. His Medicare coverage ended, and he needs either $175 per therapy visit, or $35 an hour to hire a personal trainer. The donate button at http://savingcaptaincrunch.com can still be used to donate funds to help Crunchman. Heading. In popular culture. John Draper appears as himself in the unreleased documentary Hackers Wanted. John Draper's story has also inspired several mentions in popular culture. Elements of the movie Sneakers recall Draper, and Joy Bubbles. The character Irwin Whistler, Emory portrayed by David Strathairn, as well as Cosmo's experience of offering freaking services to criminals while in prison, were based on them. John Draper is specifically mentioned as Captain Crunch in one scene in Cowboy Bebop, the movie, in which a hacker mentions that Captain Crunch broke into the national phone system with a plastic whistle. He is portrayed by Wayne Payer in the movie Pirates of Silicon Valley. Captain Crunch is being searched for by Rockford during a murder investigation on the TV show Rockford Files, Season 5, Episode 5, Kill the Messenger. Okay. That's it. On to the interview.
Alright, this is OMG from Cacti Radio, and I am on the phone right now with Captain Crunch.
Hello, how are you out there in radio land? Or should I say internet land?
We pretend to be a real radio station here.
That's the funny thing about internet radio, is they always like to pretend they're terrestrial radio stations that have frequencies and frequented frequently and all that stuff. It's crazy.
Yeah. I always joke about if we lose the stream or something, I say that RBC came in and turned off the whole station. Mm. So, yeah, we're really glad to have you. Everyone's all psyched, and we're going to take calls after we're done with the interview. The number to call in is 484-240-4050. Let's go ahead and get on with it. My first question is, how did you find out about phone phreaking?
It was sort of like an interesting call. I was experimenting around with an FM transmitter, and I get this call from a listener, or a person who picked up the transmission. He was only about 2 kilometers away, so I wasn't expecting it to go very far. Actually, the antenna was in my bedroom, so I went out about 2 miles, and he picked it up, and it was quite clear. And he wanted to know whether I was a real radio station, and I told him no, it wasn't a real radio station, that I was just transmitting, I was just experimenting around with a transmitter. I wasn't really intending the signal to go out very far at all, but I did want to put a real antenna on it instead of a dummy load. A dummy load is something that emulates an antenna but doesn't radiate the signal.
Oh, okay.
It's like a load, and you dump your power into this load and it heats up.
So it's a decoy.
Yeah, it's just something to absorb the radio frequencies.
Okay. And he told you about it?
Let me finish. So he basically, and I gave him the information, and then all of a sudden I got another call 2 weeks later with the same guy on the phone, and I says, hey, aren't you the one that called for the radio station? Because he gave me a phone number that ended in 40044. I called that number because I made a change to my antenna. So I went in and tried to call him. I asked him what his phone number was. He gave it to me as 0044. That was the A side of a loop around number. A loop around number is a number where it's two consecutive numbers, 0044 and 0045, 264-0044 actually. And you call the 0044 side, you get a tone, and you call the 0045 side, and the tone goes away, and you would talk.
Right.
So after I got his number, I went ahead and took a couple of days. I tried to call him back, and I got this tone. And then when he called me 2 weeks later, I asked him what that tone was, and he said it was a loop around. And I said, what's the loop around number? And that's how I got started phone freaking, because he was a phone freak. And then I said, what's a phone freak? And he told me what a phone freak was. And I said, you mean you guys make free phone calls? And I says, can you make free phone calls? He says, yeah, I've got about 20 different ways of making free phone calls. I says, oh, yeah, well, this is interesting. I wasn't really working, so I really had a need for making free phone calls and trying to find a job.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking for a job at Motorola, and they're in Phoenix, so I had to make a lot of calls to Phoenix. So I asked him, I says, is there any way I could learn how to do this? He says, yeah. I says, well, can I come over and visit you? And he says, yeah. So he gave me his address, and I says, can you give me directions? He said, no. I says, why not? Because he said, I'm blind. I says, okay, fine. So I go over, I knock on the door, and his father answers, and here I am, 26-year-old guy, knocking on the door, asking to talk to his son. Yeah, it didn't go over too well with his dad.
Aw.
But he let me in. Yeah, and he escorted me back to his room, and here I was. I go in his room, totally dark, and there's about four phone freaks in there. One of them was partially blind, that was Denny, and then the other two were totally blind. And I says, okay, here I am, tell me what to do, tell me how to make free phone calls. And Jimmy, the organist, the guy that plays the organ, was happy to show me how multi-frequencies worked.
Mm-hmm.
So he used his Hammond organ to make a free multi-frequency call. He says, first you call an 800 number, and then you whistle it off, and then you dial these numbers. And I says, well, how do you dial the number? And he played two notes simultaneously on a keyboard to get the notes. And I says, gee, that sounds like touch tones. And at the time, there was really no touch tone service. I really didn't know how touch tones sounded like. I had not been exposed to touch tones until very early on. Almost, I'd say maybe a month or so after I had gotten introduced to multi-frequencies.
Oh, is that because you had a rotary phone?
Yeah. We did not have phone. We did not have touch tone service in the area where I was living. So.
Okay.
So I says, great. Well, how do you do this? He says, you call up like a toll-free number. I says, okay. And he whistle it off like this. And he whistles, and he goes, chink, and the third little chirp sound. I says, oh, this is interesting. I remember hearing that sound when I was on the Autobahn in the military.
Mm.
I says, okay, well, then what you next is you have to do an opening tone. This is key pulse. And then here's the number, beep, 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 and a start. I says, can you give me the frequencies of the tones? He says, yeah, and he gave me the frequencies of the tones, and they were really easy to remember. It was 700, 900, 1100, 1500, 1700, and 1500, and 1700, and used two out of the six tones
to
make the number. For instance, 700 would be 0 plus 700. One would be 0 plus each number. Each 700 was a weight of 1. 900 had a weight of 2. 1100 had a weight of 4. And 1500 had a weight of 7. And 1700 was a special that was used in key pulse at start.
Okay.
All I had to do is to just put the two numbers together and add them together, and then that would make my number. So 7 plus 1. Is 7 plus 1 would be 1500 plus 700. the digit 3 is 2 plus 1, so that'd be 700 plus 900. And then there was a 0, of course, better than no. Okay, so I knew the frequencies, I knew the keyboard, I knew the key equivalents. So then I went home real quick, and I started to build a blue box because I had all the parts that I needed. I just needed the oscillators, and I had to know what frequency the oscillators were. And so I just used the piano keyboard as a tuning device for doing it. And I got it accurate enough to actually work, and I was really surprised. I mean, I freaked out. Oh, my God, it works. I was screaming and running like a banshee with his head cut off. I swear.
Did they ask you to do it for them?
Or? I thought I was really nuts. What?
Did they ask you to do it for them, or were you just doing it for your own use?
I was doing it for my own use. I found it very intriguing, and the only thing I needed for is to make a few phone calls to Phoenix and save a couple bucks. Yeah. After that, there was nobody to call, so who was I going to call? You know,
yeah.
I had friends overseas, or that I learned how to call overseas, but overseas calling didn't exist at the time. We didn't get that till later.
Oh.
And so I had a few friends in the military from the military base I was at in Maine. And so I called the military base operator up and asked to talk to some GI I had a friend with.
Mm-hmm.
And so those were basically the only numbers I called. I had a few scattered friends throughout the country that I could call, but there wasn't that many people that I really had a need to call. And once I talked to them, once I called them up, I talked to them until I'm tired of talking to them anymore. And I say, okay, got to go, you know, and then you'll call them again, right? You just call them one time. And, you know, why should I call my friend Mike again the next day when I'd already been talking to him for 2 hours the previous time? I got caught up with my friend News and all that stuff. And there's no reason to call anybody else twice.
Right.
I make the call once, talk to them as long as I like. Mm-hmm. And that's it. Usually it winds up to be anywhere between, you know, I don't think any of them took anything longer than an hour and a half.
Ah, I understand. So the way that you found out...
The next question is, let me answer that as well. What is a blue box and why did I make one? A blue box is the device that actually sends those tones out. And why I wanted to make one was pretty obvious. I was very intrigued in what it can do. And the number one and other reason of why I did it was because I wanted to save a couple bucks on a call to Phoenix because I hadn't been working.
Okay. Well, did you ever get that job, or?
No, actually, I didn't.
Okay. Well, you said that you found out about phone phreaking while you were in your van.
And let me explain the van.
Can you explain the van and what was in it?
Yeah. Everybody asked me about the van.
Yeah.
It's just a standard Volkswagen van.
Okay.
With the seats cut out. Of the front two seats were removed in the back, and there was a section in there where I could flop the seat down, and I could put my radio station DJ unit on top of that. So then it was like a DJ setup facing toward the back. It was next to the back seat, facing toward the back.
Mm-hmm.
I had a mixer board, and the transmitter was in a special little hermetically sealed metal box so that it wouldn't interfere with anything. It had all kinds of wires coming out of it and stuff. And then it was put out over and then it had an antenna connected to it. And the antenna was up on the sunroof of the car. I'd roll the sunroof down, put the antenna out there and roll the sunroof back and put the cable through and connect it to the transmitter. I had a problem with the radio, with the RF getting into the audio.
Yeah.
The transmitter power was 75 watts, and we have 75 watts signal next to your radios, next to your audio stuff. Your audio stuff can tend to really kind of freak out. I had to put all kinds of filters and bypass filters and stuff like that to filter out the RF.
So it was, was there any sort of freaking equipment that you ended up putting in there?
Yeah, let me get to that.
Okay.
I had a little patch unit that would patch to my thing. The idea was that I could pull up, they have these phones.
Mm-hmm.
They're called phone from car. And you could drive up to the phone, you could pull out the phone, you could make a phone call.
Right.
There weren't very many of them, but there were enough around the area that I could make use of and be reasonably safe in using it. So what I would do is I would drive up to the payphone. And payphones, you couldn't dial an 800 number direct from payphones. Because TSPS which is an old operator-handled long-distance system, mm-hmm. which has now all been replaced with more new modern stuff, I'm sure. The TSPS operator, anyway, so the operator would come on, and I would say, I'd like to make a call, please, and she connected me to the 800 number. But every mm-hmm. time I whistled 2600 into the phone, the operator would come on the line.
Ah.
And I says, whoa, what's going on here? I says, operator, I'm not done with the call. Mm-hmm. And she says, but your supervisory light went on. It looked to me like they hung up. I says, operator, those supervisory lights you got on your board are caused by a data transmission. So just ignore the data transmission and wait for me to hang up. Only go by my light. Don't go by the other light.
Mm-hmm.
So from that point on, I learned how to place a call from a payphone through an operator. I'd say, hey, operator, I wish to make a special data call on an 800 number. Would you please connect me to 800, yada, yada, yada. And it says, by the way, your supervisory lights will flash, and if it does, just ignore the false supervision. She says, how do you know all about this stuff? Operator, I've been making data calls for the longest time now, and believe you me, I've had this problem before. Trust me, that's all I can tell you, and it's all I know. And she put the call.
That's great. That's great. Okay. So you got around that.
So that little special patch panel was kind of cool because it was set up so that I could operate it from the driver's side. It was this little box connected to a cord that would go out to the payphone. Now, I would like to directly couple to the payphone. Now, there's only one way to do that. You had to get in the back of the payphone, and you had to peel away the wires of the payphone, and you have to clip the direct wires directly into the tip and ring of the payphone line coming in. There was, okay. In some of these payphones, the metal conduit thing that was going to the payphone was worn off or chipped off. I could get access to the wires. So what I did was, on all the different payphones that had that particular kind of conduit, I could get access to the wires inside there, and I clipped small little clip leads onto the payphone. There's a little cap that covers the conduit. So what I did was I unscrewed the cap, pulled the cap off, and there were the exposing of the wires. And then I made the screws tight and loose enough where I can easily loosen them up. So all I had to do was to pull up to the payphone, go outside, hook the conduit up, get little clip leads, and clip the leads to the cables on my car.
Mm-hmm.
So then I would go back to the and the cables would be easily removed, so that when I drive away, in case I had to make a quick getaway, it would just the wires would just simply break off real easy for quick getaways, because I knew that I thought that maybe.
Yeah. Did that ever happen? Did you ever have to get away quickly? Yeah.
No, but I understand from earlier court documents from one of the witnesses that came up that the police came literally seconds after I had left.
Wow. Wow.
I was on there especially a long time. Mm-hmm. I was on there doing all kinds of tandem stacking and experimenting around with trunks. I was flashing her supervisory signals up the wazoo, and she had to try to take the temptation not to go up there and try to take the call down.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
You know, later on, Los Gatos became freakable without using an operator. And then I did it over in Los Gatos. It was much better. But Los Gatos didn't have those car phones.
Oh, drive up. Okay.
So I had to pull us. All I did was I pull up to the payphone, okay, and just simply run the wire out of my car, which was a pretty thin wire, really hard to see. I ran it along the ground, in between the two tires of the front car, and ran it around, and I kind of hit it kind of behind the grass and made it look. And then those were I could really freak really good, because those didn't require an operator, and I could stay on the line and no one would know about it, because I would make the call cleanly and not cause any problems. And in Los Gatos, to get on a trunk, all you had to do is just hit the hook switch, flash real fast, just wipe your finger across the hook switch, just like that, and trip, clock, plump, and you're right in the trunk, just like that.
So it never really looked suspicious, because I was wondering about that.
Technically, no, it would not look suspicious at all. There was no way that any of the switching equipment could tell, because I emulated exactly what the switching equipment could do. There was just a fraction of a second there where I dropped, where I released an hook switch before the local thing, before the local switching mechanism in the phone would give me the dial tone.
Okay. But I mean...
But the distant circuitry would see that supervisory shift where I would, you know, hang the phone up. It would see that phone hang up sooner than the local switch would. So it would then drop me off the local dial tone and drop me in a trunk instead of just drop me off locally.
Okay.
It was just a very, very small little split second of time in it. You could do it right.
Well, I meant visually, you're saying it's a very thin wire, nobody really noticed visually.
No, and I usually did it at night, and if I saw a cop car pulled up, I'm already in the driver's seat, so I would just start the car and pull away.
Oh, okay.
If I pulled away, the wire would still be there, but...
Yeah. But you could replace that.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. I mean, now, during this time, or I guess any time, were you ever homeless and you used braking, I guess?
There was a time when I moved out of my parents' place. I moved in this house with a bunch of hippie people, and I was really not homeless. I would pretty much just live in my van just for the convenience of it and all that. And so it didn't matter to me whether I had a place to stay or not, other than, of course, wanting to take a shower. I could usually do that by going home to my parents and taking a shower or go to the gym at the school, because I could go in. I was going to college, and I could just go into the gym anytime and use the shower.
Oh, okay.
It was open until 5 o'clock. It was actually open until 7 o'clock every night, so I was going there if I was not living, you know. And I had access to Stanford. I had access to City College. I had access to De Anza gyms, and they're easy to get into. You just walk in and use the shower like you're a student. Nobody ever questioned me.
Ah, it's pretty easy to blend in places where there's a lot of people like that. I've done that too.
So that's what it was. And I had the freedom because that meant that I didn't have to stay home. I would go to any city I wanted to go in. You ever seen it? Back a long time ago, back in the late 60s, late 60s, there was a program called Then Came Bronson. It's on TV.
Oh, no, I didn't see
it. It's about this motorcycle rider, drives around in the country, goes from place to place. He pulls up. Next to this car, this commuter guy, and he says, where are you going? I says, wherever I wind up. And the guy says, I wish I were like you. So it's like I was like that guy. I would go from place to place. So I didn't have an address. I didn't have a home phone. I didn't need a home phone because any time I needed to make a phone call, I would make the phone calls. And I had one or two people that I knew really well who take calls for me.
Oh.
And these people, of course, would... There was no need for answering machines. They didn't even exist back then. I didn't have one until about 6 months later. It was an old mechanical device.
Mm-hmm.
It had you put this telephone on this little device, and there were these little two forked fingers that come underneath the handset of the phone that lifts the thing off the phone. There's a speaker next to the earpiece, and then there's a magnetic coupler you put around the earpiece.
Oh, okay. So it's...
And you put the magnetic ring around the earpiece and that was all it would, and it would just connect to the box, and it would detect the ring somehow, and it would just pick up the phone, and an audio voice would come on the speaker into the mouthpiece of the phone saying, John's not here right now, or press.
So did you have to build that, or?
No, this was somebody gave me. It was called Ansaphone, A-N-S-A-F-O-N-E.
Oh, okay.
Typical mechanical. I got it at a flea market, actually. I paid about $100 for it.
It's really cool.
It was worth about $500 or $600, so they were pretty expensive.
Well, what about the jail time that you spent? What was that like, and how did you survive in jail?
Well, one of the first things I had learned was, before I went to jail, I had time to think about it, and I met with Timothy Leary, who'd just gotten out of jail.
Mm-hmm.
And he was filling me in on what jail time is like and what you should do. And so I pretty much followed his suggestions. Pretty much this. Find the biggest and strongest person in the jail who runs it. find the master inmate who controls every other inmate. There's usually one leader. He's usually a big guy, big muscular guy, gang leader kind of person. Make friends with this person. And it was easy for me to make friends with anybody in jail because everybody wanted to make free phone calls in jail.
Yeah, you had the knowledge.
Right. So that's what protected me. So I got the biggest and meanest and beefiest person in the world to kind of like protect me. And no one would give me any shit in jail from that point on. And I just, you know, I was in my room. I was busily writing down all my notes on the phone system. And then I was sending it to my attorney as legal mail, which they can't open. Oh. And then later on I would send it to TAP.
Okay. So
TAP is the newsletter for phone freaks. It was kind of like the precursor to 2600.
Yeah. Okay. So while you were in jail, I guess you taught everyone about the system.
Yeah, I had classes every Tuesday and Thursday night right after count. They had a 7 o'clock count, and right after 7 o'clock count, you had 2 hours. You weren't allowed to go after beyond a certain boundary. This was like Lompoc Federal Prison. You had certain boundary lines you can go to.
Okay.
They have the inner boundary line where you can go between A wing and B wing, and you can go to the rec room.
And were people watching, or?
Well, yeah, they got. Yeah, of course they're watching. Okay. They got night vision people watching you, I'm sure. But then after that, that was before 4 o'clock, and then you had the 4 o'clock count, and then you had chow. So right before the 4 o'clock count, you could go anywhere in this big, wide, expansive field. And in that field, you would have, like, a baseball diamond and basketball courts. And,
oh, okay.
And a running track and a park course and all that. But after chow, you only can go between A building and B building. And inside the rec room there, I would have lessons at a certain time.
I see.
And it was pretty easy to find because we'd situate ourselves in the rec room so that the cops couldn't hear us. And because remember, this was a minimum security.
Mm-hmm.
Cops are always around. They're always there. There's at least one cop in the rec room, but they're not going to listen to what I'm saying if I'm just sitting around at a table playing cards with somebody or playing backgammon with somebody.
Well,
and we'd always do this over like a card game or a backgammon game.
Okay.
It would just be me talking to these guys.
So they never really knew, because you'd think after a while they might catch on.
No. And everybody would protect me. Nobody would snitch on me, because they definitely wanted the information.
Yeah. Were you guys actually able to use the information while you're in jail, or did they wait until they got out?
No, you can actually do it from in there.
Oh.
It was pretty easy. I had a huge collection of loop-around numbers, and every week I'd give out a new loop-around number to use for people to use for making calls. And in jail, the only way you can make a call is to make a collect call.
Oh.
So
and
what
then
you
it
do,
was free.
What you do is you make a collect call to the B side of a loop.
Right.
And then my friend is sitting on the A side of the loop, ready to accept the charges of a call.
That's very clever.
Go fill it to the loop around number.
So to the system, they could hear the audio of the person accepting.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. That sounds very
Hollywood
very
work
good.
Today, because those automatic collect call systems have to have audio somewhere.
Do you think it would work today?
I think it might, if you knew the loop around numbers.
So
the trick is getting loop around numbers. So they're often called cheese boxes. People who do horse racing and stuff like that, or you know, illegal betting would use these often. And what you do is you have two phone lines set up that emulate the loop around number with a two-way amplifier on the phone line.
Okay.
So if you call one side of the phone line, it would sit there dead, or it would sit there with some type of an audio source coming out, and then when that audio source goes away, when somebody calls in, you can get notified by that. So then, call coming in. I go over and I pick up the other line. I say, I know where the call's coming from. Can only a call come from one place?
Right.
Jail. So the automatic recording will come on. Would you accept the call? Press such and such. Yeah, sure, I accept the call. Why not?
So actually, the other day I was looking for loop around for loop numbers, and I couldn't find any.
The best I know, you can't get them anymore. They don't use them anymore. The best way is to make your own. All you need is two phone lines, and you just need a two-way line tie. Two-way line tie, that's it, really. And those are on the internet. You can probably find them pretty easily.
I remember the last time that I used...
You want to have them computer controlled.
Yeah.
Heck, man, with this, you could probably make an infinite number loop around number by having a by using a an Asterisk PBX and programming it.
Okay. But I remember there was a loop, it was about 5 years ago that I used to call. So I guess it's a very recent thing that they've gotten rid of.
Yeah, I would imagine so, yeah.
Oh, that's a shame.
Let's see, where we at with the questions here? Let's see, I've already answered the homeless thing.
I was going to ask you, while you were in jail, I read that you actually wrote a program for Mac.
That wasn't until later. That was the second jail term. I remember I was in jail for twice.
How did that come about with Apple?
You got the timeline right. It says here, how did I start working with Apple?
Right.
Okay, I can tell you how I did that. I met Steve Wozniak. At the time, wasn't working for Apple, but he was at the Homebrew Computer Club, and he built this Apple I computer.
Mm-hmm.
And he would be typing it in hex. Just before the thing, it was 2K for integer basic. He wrote integer basic in 2K of 6502 assembly code, and it took up about 2K of memory.
Wow, it's
really
small.
So I met him there. We talked. Woz was the person, by the way, who I had met even before the Homebrew Computer Club, because he called me up. Okay, KPFA had a radio program on, and I was on the radio program. And during the radio program, I would demonstrate tandem stacking. Wozniak heard the program, because this was at UCLA. This was UC Berkeley.
Okay.
And
this was not out of your van.
No. This is a regular, legit commercial. It wasn't commercial, but it was an educational station run by Stanford. It was a public service station, rather.
Oh, okay.
KPFA.
Okay.
And so I got on a KPFA. One of the persons on KPFA invited me on, and so, yeah, I went on. And so he gave me the number to call in, and I called in from a very, very discreet location, by the way. And I demonstrated tandem stacking, and what I would do is I would call KPFA up on their number and stack a whole bunch of tandems, and then I would hang up, and they'd could hear all the chirps disconnecting.
Okay.
Hello?
Yeah.
Here?
Okay. Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay.
I'm just listening.
Okay, then after that, okay, it went off pretty big, and that was a thing that Woz heard. Woz says, I got to contact this guy. And all that they knew was that I worked at KPF at KKUP on Saturday night. Now, Woz found out about it from there was another person at KPFA that interviewed me, but this other person, Alan, who also worked at KPFA, knew Steve Wozniak.
Okay.
And told Steve Wozniak that he knew of me because I told Alan that I was working at K-Cup. So Woz calls me at K-Cup, KKUP, when I was on the air. And I talked to Woz. And he says, hey, I heard you on KPFA, and I was wondering if we could get together and yada, yada, yada. And I says, I really want to meet you. And I says, well, you know, I really got to be kind of discreet with this, so I could probably arrange a meeting with you. So why don't you tell me where and when you want me to meet, and I'll meet with you. I'm available after 6 any evening, but I'd prefer to do it later because of traffic. So he said, fine. So I arranged to meet with him in the dorm room at UC Berkeley in the dorm room. And
okay.
he had his blue box there, and he asked me to show him how to use it. And I says, well, what are we on here? We're on your UC Berkeley, UC Berkeley dorm phone. He says, yeah. He says, what do you do to dial out? He says, you dial 9. Okay, fine. Now, how are you going to be able to, are you going to make your calls from the dorm room? I says, that's a pretty dumb thing to do. unless it's going to be, unless you can somehow make it from another phone somewhere else on the dorm. So they won't recognize it as you.
Because every pay phone.
Well, every dorm had their own phone number, see, on the UC Berkeley PBX system.
Yeah, it's much better at a payphone.
Well, yeah, but it was too complex for me to tell him how to do it from a payphone because he didn't understand the concept of doing a data call.
Oh, okay. And you wanted to show him first before.
I wanted to show him first, and it wouldn't hurt to do it from a dorm phone because he assured me that he could tie into he tied me into the B box downstairs where the PBX lines come in, and so he was able to find a safe line to clomp onto. Okay. So he did that. We dialed 9 to get out. We dialed an 800 number. I said, okay, now you send your 2600 tone here. And then it didn't work on his box because his box he was using square waves for the 2600. And if you send a square wave into the phone line, it's probably not going to be a very good thing to do because it's going to generate all kinds of subharmonics and all kinds of other superfluous noises. So it took us a while to figure out how to get around that. So we wound up having to correctly do that. Hang on a minute. My other friend's coming over, wants me to text him.
Okay.
My address. Let me do it real quick.
If you'd like, I can make go an to the song real quick.
What's that?
I can go to music, and we can come back. You can talk.
I'm almost done.
Okay. Do, 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 do.
There you go.
I'll just make music with my mouth. Do 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 do
do do do do do do do do. Okay, we're back now.
Okay, you're back.
Yeah, sorry about that. All right.
I just want to say you have a really good ear because all I did is mute my Skype because my kids are kind of up and awake for some weird reason. And all I did was mute my Skype, and you thought that the call had dropped. And I don't know. You must have, like, magic ears.
Well, there is an ambient background noise you usually get when there's a Skype call from the microphone noise, things in the background, even like a small fan motor running. And just ambient noise in a room. That microphone can pick that stuff up. And when you mute that microphone, you're disconnecting from that ambient noise, and I felt I can sense a very small change in that background noise. Okay, let's go on with my questions here. Dale,
story about teaching.
We're sorry about Apple. Story about Apple.
Yes.
Okay.
You were teaching him about the next, boxing.
Yeah, after I taught him about boxing, about several years passed, and I had a job working at Call Computer. And this was during the microprocessor age. I went to several homebrew computer club meetings, and I knew right away that there was a need for somebody to have an assembler to write assembly language instructions using opcodes rather than remembering what the hex code is for the number. So I wrote an assembler. Cross assembler. It was written in BASIC. It was working on Call Computer, which is a BTI BASIC system. Mm-hmm. I did one for the 6800, one for the 8080, and then Randy Wigginton then did the 6502 because he was working with WAS, and WAS needed the 6502. So, but I didn't have time to do it because I was working somewhere else. So he took the task of doing it. Then that 6502 assembler code was what WAS used, and that same code that printout you get in the famous Red Book. When Apple first came out, they published a document called the Red Book. In the back of the Red Book was a 6502 assembly language source code for the monitor ROM. Apple, WAS is an open source guy. He wants everybody to know It wants the computer to be totally open so people can dabble with it and play with it.
Oh.
And so he actually wrote the monitor ROM code so you could understand how to talk to the how to talk to the I/O and stuff. You have to poke into certain memory locations to get things to happen. And so that's what I meant WAS. So I worked with WAS, and then after a while, I went to my first sentencing. I got sentenced at that point, and then I had to go to Lompoc. But when I returned from Lompoc, at that time WAS had already gotten the Apple II done, and so I got immediately hooked up back with WAS on the Apple II. And WAS asked me what if I could make a phone interface board. And I said, sure, why not? That'd be a cool thing to do. So I designed the phone interface board around certain kind of digital switches, analog switches and stuff like that that would switch on and off the phone and relay. It had a couple relays in it, stuff like that. And you could then, and then I had it set up so that you could, if you poke a certain memory location on the Apple, the relay would click, it would drop off and get you a dial tone. And if you poke an adjacent memory location, the dial tone would go, it would disconnect from the phone line. And then I had a little audio amplifier set up so that you could pass audio from the board itself, because they had to have a touch tone generator. So I did the tones in software. I made all the tones in software by, making the 6502, so the Apple II would actually make the tones in software, and then the touch tones and the dial tones and all that. The dial tone detection was using a phase lock loop, a programmable phase lock loop that I could use to detect the dial tone. I looked for the major frequency in the dial tone for two phase lock loops, and when the dial tone's what 480 and 360, something like that. So I would take those two tones and program the programmable phase lock loop to lock onto those two tones.
Mm-hmm.
So when it would hear those two tones from the little amplifier on the board, then you would know that they picked up the phone and the other end had a dial tone on the other end. And then I figured out how to detect ringing and busy and talk the difference between a ring and a busy. And these were little simple 6502 subroutines that I had used.
Okay.
But something in the A register, and it's something in the X register, and something in the Y register, and then you made a call to a certain memory location, call minus something or other, minus 256, whatever it is, and that goes to the assembly language routine. It would go out and talk to the board and pick up the line and stuff. Later on, a couple of did it in integer basic, but I made the call standardized so they could just do it either with integer basic or with just regular phone. I did it in 6502, and then I did it in integer basic. It was easier.
Now, then you went on to write a program while you were in jail for Apple?
I didn't write the program for Apple. I wrote a word processor program.
Right. Yeah.
That was when I got sent to the work furlough program, and they would let me out during the daytime to go to a job,
mm-hmm.
and then at nighttime I'd go back to jail after 5:30. I'd have to report back to jail before 6, and I was given a certain amount of time to get back into the jail. I wasn't allowed to stop off anywhere and go to the store. I was only allowed to go directly to and from work, and they would follow me, and you know they did follow me. I can tell you that. They do follow you. They do keep close tabs on you for sure. And there was one time when I got a flat tire on my way back to work. And I got it fixed in enough time to go back and not miss my curfew.
Well, they would know that you had a flat tire, though.
They did indeed. They told me the next day. They told me the next day. They saw me out there changing the tire.
Oh, okay. Can we go ahead and go to a music break for about 5 minutes? Do you mind holding on?
Yeah, I could use a break. Yeah, sure.
Okay.
As long as I could hear the music.
Okay.
I
don't think you'll be able to hear the music.
That's okay. What are you playing?
I'm going to play, let me look at what it is. Well, actually, what I can do, I can play New Edition, Mr. Telephone Man. Do you like that song?
Sure, why not? If the other listeners like it, sure.
Oh, I'm sure they pretty much don't have a choice. Sometimes I play Backstreet Boys for them.
Well, I remember that song.
So.
Have fun. I'll be right here.
Bye, all right. Baby. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, and now we are back, and I'm still with Captain Crunch. I want to thank everyone for holding on. Now, we were talking about, I think we've covered just about everything pretty soon.
I'm not the right Easy Rider. I basically wrote Easy Rider when I was in jail.
Mm-hmm.
Here's how that worked out. That worked out quite well. I was really amazed I was able to pull that off and get away with it. I had to, of course, find a job.
Mm-hmm.
And if I didn't find a job, I would have to stay at the work furlough program all the time and from there try to find a job.
Oh, okay.
Didn't have a job.
You had to.
So I had to find a job. So what I did was I found a quote-unquote job. The job was working for Receiving Studios. Receiving Studios was nothing more than a practice space with a bunch of Berkeley hippie band players who had this nice big practice space, and on the front door it says Receiving, and that's why they call it Receiving Studios. I got to know them from many, many years ago. They asked me to help them build a mixer board for their recording studio, and I've always been able to help them out with their computer work and stuff like that, and they reciprocated by allowing me to so-called quote-unquote work for them, and they would vouch for me.
Mm-hmm.
So what would happen was they had letterhead already set up on there, and they wrote a letter. They basically had to write a letter as an employer, mm-hmm. had to write a letter to the work furlough program saying, we're hiring this person, we agree with your terms, because I was required to give my employer a list of things I wasn't supposed to do. There was a whole bunch of things I wasn't supposed to go out. I wasn't supposed to go anywhere. I was supposed to stay in the work site or in the work area where I could leave the work area as long as it had to do with work site, which means I could go off site. That was cool. I was even allowed to go to the West Coast Computer Fair.
Okay.
Today.
Because it was considered work.
Exactly.
Good.
So all I had to do was just basically let them know all I had to do was call them up and tell them where I was going and when I was going and when I was coming back.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like boarding school to me from when I was in boarding school.
That's what it was. It was almost boarding school, except they kept a really close eye on you.
Yeah. They didn't really keep a close eye on me. I got into all sorts of trouble.
Yeah. Anyway, so what happened was basically they also had a commercial checking account.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever I would find work from, I had money coming in from some sources, and I would take that money coming in and pay it to Receiving Studios, because then they could then mm-hmm. pay me back that money by writing a check with the Receiving Studios name on it as my paycheck.
That's what I was wondering.
I told them that this was how I get paid, and it was a job getting paid $650 a month.
Oh, okay.
Which at the time was probably a pretty good job.
Sounds like a good gig.
It was basically entry level programming wage roughly at that time.
Okay.
And so I told them I was programming computers and all that, and I asked the work furlough program, can I take some of my listings home with me so that I can study more? They said fine. So after every work day, I would take and print out the entire source listing of Easy Rider. I was written in fourth, by the way. I would take it back to the dorm with me, back to the jail with me, and I would go over it with a fine-tooth comb. I would draw a stack diagram for every word. I'd print it out double spacing to have enough room for the stack diagram. And then I would mark up the sheet of paper. I would test it out. I would test it out by visually running the code visually as if I was a computer. And I found all kinds of errors and mistakes and wrote down changes on the source listing, just scribbled on the source listing what the changes were.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was too much to change to fit in, then I would draw a 1 or a 2 or a 3 with a circle around it.
Mm-hmm.
And that would refer to an external page. And that external page would have the code on it that I'd have to put in.
Oh, okay.
So then,
at this point, you were really hoping for a word processor.
No, I was writing the word processor.
that was kind of a joke. Like,
And it worked very, very well. It was actually the ideal programming situation anybody could ever have. It allowed me to be able to get away from the computer and gather my thoughts and figuring out what to do. It worked out really well for me. It was amazingly done. So then when I went back, I took the code, I retyped in the changes to it, and then I ran it through a debugger, and I stepped through the single step and looking at the stack as I was single stepping through the code, and I was very careful to get all the little pieces working correctly, and so that was how it worked out quite well, actually. I designed it in such a way that I separated the display and the keyboard functions from the machine itself, so then I could do it on other machines and using the transportability of Forth, because it's a very transportable language, to work it on other machines. Because my plan was to do it on a CPM machine or also on another machine. It turned out that IBM beat me to it, and they wanted it on their PCs. And so they Easy Rider was really taken off good. We made number two in the SoftTalk Hit Parade as the word processor to get, and IBM people were sneaking around looking for the best people to do a word processor. They snuck into our publisher without me knowing about it.
Oh wow!
And got a demo of Easy Rider with the appropriate people, and they liked it. And they said, "Well, what will it take to port this to our new computer that we had?" The Bill had already signed the non-disclosure, but I hadn't signed it yet.
Oh.
So Bill said, "Well, I don't know what it's going to take for John to get this on for our programmers." He called it our programmers. Yet IBM, remember, in IBM culture, it's no one person writing a program; it's like 20 people writing a program.
Okay.
So that's IBM's train of thought, you know.
Huh.
They thought it would probably take 20 programmers a year to do it. You know?
Well, so Bill
Bill made a quote to say 6 months, and they accepted that. they basically worked out some milestones. Milestone number one was to port Forth to the IBM PC. Yeah. Milestone number two was to port the editor onto the IBM PC without the printer system subsystem. And then milestone number three was the file system on there. And milestone number four was a print subsystem to get the printer to working. So these were the four milestones that we had to go by. And Bill had all worked it out, how long it'll take. And Bill consulted with me without telling me, by the way. So he said, by the way, when we went, he says, we says he only told me that it was going to be on an 8086. That's all I knew. Okay, so I says, how long will it take? I says, well, Bill, I got to port it to 8086. There's a fourth source available for the 8086 already. I can take that and I could put it onto this machine. I says, what's the machine? He says, I won't tell you yet, but I will tell you it's an 8086. So I did some sleuthing around and I found out that there was an 8086 machine that I could buy, that had 8086 on it, and it had Seattle Computer Products DOS on it. And so I bought the machine, because we had the money to do it, and then I went out and hired an 8086 programmer, and he helped me get Forth running on the machine. So we ported the Forth over by taking the actual assembly language of the Forth, and we converted it into Forth assembly language, and then we took that, and then we put it onto the machine in binary. So then we made a binhex file of it, out of a .hex file out of it, and which was a way of getting binary data that's from a text source into binary into the machine.
Oh, okay.
It's using hexadecimal stuff.
Okay. So, let's see. What are you currently working on right now? What's your big project? I think I saw something on Facebook today.
Well, right now, my biggest and my major thing right now, I'm spending about 95% of my time healing myself.
Oh, okay.
I had a most unfortunate situation when I was at DEF CON. Some douchebag in DEF CON pulled down on my neck really hard. I mean, it was a friendly gesture and all, but he was pretty rough on me.
Was this just last year?
Yeah.
Last July?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he broke something.
Oh.
And so I had to go to the doctor. The doctor did an MRI, and I found out that the vertebrae was misplaced by about 3 millimeters.
Oh, wow.
And I was pinching my root nerve in my spinal cord, and it was, and those were the nasty nerves, and it went out on the root nerves for my hands and arms only.
Gosh, almost that's immediately the most after unfortunate. That happened,
almost my hands started getting numb.
Wow.
After 3 or 4 days, it started getting hard to type, and then I had to go to the doctor, and then I saw the surgeon, and then I was investigating endoscopic treatments, which were non-invasive, but I found out later on that I had to have surgery because the vertebrae themselves were displaced, and I couldn't just clear out the root canal. I had to clear out all that other stuff. I don't want to call it a root canal because you can associate that with teeth. So well, I would call that a little groove inside your spinal cord where the root nerves come out that go down to your arms and hands. I did a lot of research in body anatomy.
Mm-hmm.
I studied up on the particular thing. It's called RSD. It's called reflexive sympathetic dystrophy.
Okay.
Google it if you want. And it's caught, and the initial trigger was that pinched nerve. Once that happens, there's no cure, okay? The only thing that can make that better is physical therapy, and physical therapy can maybe fix it, maybe some part of the time, but it's going to be permanent. I'm going to be permanently fucked by this
situation. Oh, man. Just by some guy giving you a really, really bad
hug. He was very rough on me. He was overweight, very heavy, put his full weight on my neck. Listen, nothing I could do but collapse and drop down and try to take the weight off as quick as possible, but it was too late.
I just can't believe it only affected, you know, your fingers and your arms and, like, the most important pieces for a programmer.
Take a look at your body anatomy.
Yeah.
And look at the nerve diagrams.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see that the nerve diagrams go from the C4, C5 vertebrae, the interface between the C4, C5, down through your hands and arms. And that there was a big spur right there. There was pinching that nerve. There was so much pressure on the nerve that it was just going completely berserk. It's like a short circuit, basically.
Hmm.
And so the brain saw that short circuit, tried to patch around it, but then that did permanent damage because once that happened, there was wouldn't go back to the original nerve signals.
Right.
The only way to make that happen is to make a better neuron connection between the brain and the muscles by using physical therapy and kinesiology and other forms of healing techniques that are known to have fixed this in previous patients.
So what did you do about it?
Well, of course, I saw the doctor about it, and I did a lot of research on it. I spent a lot of time researching the web. I read many medical journals on it. I had to get my Latin English. I had a medical Latin English website that I could go to help me translate the words from Latin into English. And
terminology.
So, because they were all using Latin, and so I had to figure that out. I learned a lot of Latin in the process.
Yeah. Medical terminology is full of that.
Well, there's also legal terminology also using Latin, so...
Yeah, it helps you in both situations.
I picked myself not learning that language in school, even though nobody spoke it at the time.
Yeah.
Except the people at the Vatican.
So,
okay, so going back to my current situation is that I'm not really doing anything right now, except I'm planning to set up a consortium of people... To solve five basic,
right? Huh? You had surgery.
I had surgery. Yes, I had it on the 21st of December. Surgery was over almost instantly. The pain went away.
Wow.
On my hands, except the residual pain was still there. So you can think of the pain dropping from like a 9 or a 10 down to a number 2 or a 3.
You're relieved.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah. It didn't matter that it hurt a little bit.
I had to wear a neck brace. I had to be very careful about how I moved. I had to wear a neck brace. I couldn't drive. I had to wear a neck brace for 2 or 3 weeks. After that, I could take it off. After about another 2 or 3 weeks, the surgeon proved me to drive, but I had to be really careful not to turn my head.
So they operated on your vertebrae, and it fixed your hands.
Oh, well, yeah, of course. Yeah, that's
very good.
That's, I mean, and then the after they did the surgery, all that pain sort of went away. But what was I going to say?
Well, you're working on a book or a movie or something.
But yeah, I'm working on my book. I'm just working on the timeline right now. In order to write a biography, you have to write a timeline.
Mm-hmm.
Timeline is basically the date and who I met, what I did, and where I went.
Right.
So it's person, location, and what I did. Person, location, what I did. Chronologically down the line.
Okay. That should be really interesting when that comes out.
That's what Excel is good for. Then I could sort by name and sort by date, you know.
I see. Well, I hope that goes well. I know your surgery and your injury probably delayed that a little bit.
Well, I'm just now getting started to pack my first meeting with my co-author in minutes. He's due over here like now.
Okay. Well, do you mind if do you have anything else you need to talk about, or do you mind?
Well,
let's
see what we got. All the questions here. The music I listen to. I like to listen to psychedelic trance, house music, techno when I'm dancing, when I'm doing my yoga and need quiet exercises. I listen to a station called Groove Kitchen or Groove Salad. It's on Soma FM. It's on the internet.
Oh, okay. What kind of music did you play when you were doing your pirate radio thing?
Mostly just rock and underground rock. If it was not played on KSJO and all the other stations, I would play it.
Oh, I see.
I would play what they don't play on the commercial radio stations.
So do you have a favorite TV show that you watch right now?
I'm getting to that. TV show. Well, when it's on, I definitely want to catch Survivor. I'm always a Survivor fan. But my favorite, I like to watch a lot of documentaries. One of my most favorite TV programs, and it's kind of a waker-upper, was called the, hang on a minute. So I have it right here. I just look it up. Hang on just a second.
Oh, okay.
I'm looking for it. It is called... hold on. I wanted people to know about it.
If this were Jeopardy,
here it is. It's called Prophets of Doom. Google it.
Oh, okay.
Watch it on the internet.
Is that like some sort of religious thing?
No, what it is, there are five basic experts. One person is an expert in food and maintaining sustainability and how people can get food in the future.
Oh.
If the energy grid collapses, how people are going to generate energy.
Okay.
If we lose our gas pipeline, how stores are going to get their food.
It's a survival show.
The guys talk about really interesting stuff about what you can do to basically locally among yourself and your family or your close neighborhood can get together and maybe grow gardens for food. I have an expert already online who is an expert in water purification systems. I'm really doing heavy duty research in battery technology, and MIT has done some amazing work in the field of nanotechnology, and they claim that they have a battery that they can do that has six times the normal battery capacity of a lithium ion battery, making electric cars more feasible. Now you can drive from Las Vegas to Now you can drive from L.A. to San Francisco on a single charge.
Wow.
Okay.
I still wouldn't want to have to recharge
other,
my
other
car.
Things, other things we're talking about also is the how General Motors should get out of the car-making business and get into the battery-making business and lease their batteries instead of rent them or people buy them, and that would reduce the cost of an electric car by $10,000 instead of paying paying $20,000 to $30,000 for your Volt, you lease the battery instead of buying it. And now what you're doing is you're saving the money on buying the car. The battery is not owned by you. The battery is owned by General Motors. So then General Motors and you have a leasing arrangement with the batteries. You pay General Motors a monthly fee for the use of a battery. But once you have that battery, that battery's guaranteed for the life of the car, so if you have a problem with it, by the way, the biggest problem in electric vehicles is 1 or 2 years you have to replace that battery. It's $10,000.
Oh, shit. That's about the price of what your car would be worth, probably.
Yeah, probably.
Oh,
so
my God.
The idea is it's pay a leasing fee.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that means it could go up to any participating service station and replace the battery. So now you can drive across country in your electric car if you can know which gas stations have leasing arrangements with your car, make and model. Then you can drive into a service station, and they yank the battery out, you pay an exchange fee, and off you go, and you're off on another 300 or 400 mile.
It's much like how they do propane tanks
Exactly.
That's a great idea.
These are the ideas that we're trying to nurture in our brain incubator. Our incubator of ideas.
Well,
we don't have our website up yet. We have our URL. We're keeping it a secret. Here's what people can do. They can go to my website. They can go to my Facebook site, facebook.com/JDCrunchman. And go there and go to my wall, and they can read my status on the wall. There is where you're going to catch the latest scoop on what I'm doing and when I'm doing it and where I'm doing it. I Twitter a lot, but I don't usually tweet my locations. Excuse me a sec. I got
to
take this.
Well, would you like to go to music and come back and people can ask you questions?
Well, go to music. We'll see you in about 5.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye. Right.
Okay, we are back, and we're back with Captain Crunch. We're going to take calls in about 5 minutes. We just wanted to finish up a topic about the consortium.
I was kind of interrupted by a phone call. Sorry about that, guys. So anyway, here's basically what I want to do, and this is what I want to let you guys know out there know. There are so many things that you could do with very little cost to help your family and yourself maintain sustainability. You can also make money on this if you are really cool and if you have maybe access to a hacker space that you can build stuff. Okay, mm-hmm. Visualize this. Okay. How many people go to Las Vegas and they want to find a shady place to park their car? It's always a problem. It's always hot and sunny there. Although I have to beg to differ with you because I was in Vegas yesterday and it was freezing cold.
Well, there's a little cold front coming through.
Yeah. So the idea is why not have a car shade mm-hmm. your car that with solar panels on top of it that you can now plug into your car, charge your car batteries, while you're gambling, or while you're shopping, while you're taking in a movie, or while you're at work, or whatever. You pull into a car shade. These car shades will only be made available to people with electric cars. They pull their car into the car shade, and they plug their car in, and the sun now shines and generates electricity, and can put a charge in your car. It's not going to fully charge your car, because it takes acres and acres of solar panels to charge your car really fast. Mm. But if you're there for 2 or 3 hours, maybe 4 hours, heck, that'll probably put anywhere between 5% and 15% of charge on your car. Better than nothing.
Yeah.
That charge on your car is a charge you don't have to suck out of your wall socket when you get home.
Well, it adds up too.
Absolutely.
It can add up.
That's just one very simple project that somebody can do. It probably wouldn't mm-hmm. take more than $1,000 worth of parts and PVC piping and plus the cost of the solar panels, you could probably build one of these things very quickly. You could probably make your own carport. I don't know whether you could have to do that without a construction permit or not, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay, anyway, so that's one item. There are many other items. Let's get on to the questions.
What's yeah, let's get on to the questions. Anybody can call now. You might have to keep it concise because I don't know how much time Captain Crunch has, but the phone number is 484-240-4050, and I'm going to try to take as many calls as I can. Caller, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. My name's Chris Tompkinson. Am I on the air or what?
Yes. Yeah, yes, we can hear you.
Oh, my God.
All of a sudden, my Skype actually woke up. Did you actually conference me in on Skype?
I called in on Skype. It's my fault.
Oh, so you're... No, you're cool. You're cool. Well, pleased to meet you.
I can hang up. I'm sorry.
No, don't worry about it. Pleased to meet you. I hear you fine, and that's what counts, right?
Okay,
good. You're talking to me now. So what's your question?
All right, I actually have two, if that's all right. I want to know, like you know, hackers are known for, like, doing pranks and stuff. So what's the last really awesome prank you did? Or like, any in the past?
I did?
Or do you do
pranks? Or a trick or something?
I can remember a long time ago when Waz pulled a prank on me. I wanted to get even with Waz. So at a party, Waz had this big dish antenna.
Oh, holy
shit.
Using
to pick up satellite TV. So I built a gun diode. I don't know whether you're familiar with a gun diode, but a gun diode and microwaves don't get along together if you don't use them right. And all I did was put this tiny little thing on.
You're like a terrorist.
On his,
you're like MacGyver,
on
a terrorist.
His antenna. And it wiped out his satellite TV reception for a few minutes, just enough to get him pissed off.
Ah, that's awesome.
What's in it?
I'm LOLing. Can I ask one other question?
Yeah, make it quick.
Okay, are you going to leave things out of your book for legal reasons? Or like, is it
no,
all
I'm
so
not,
long?
No. There's no restriction on my book. I'm gonna be open about it. I'm gonna talk about all the gory secrets I've ever done. There's no reason at all why I should keep it, why I should not put this information in there for legal reasons. There is nothing in that book, because remember, the book's a lot about phone freaking, but it's also about me. It's a life about my life, and it's about how I was born and how I was raised and my trials and tribulations as a kid and what I did when I was a kid. And a lot of that's going to be about the technical part of the book will be totally free and open. I have no restrictions about what I can say, because I don't think that there would be any legal problem at all with me saying anything I want about what I did.
Has it been long enough since you've been freaking?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a statute of limitations involved as well. I'm probably protected by that as well. But there's nothing that I could say. Number one, because the system that I worked on does not exist anymore. It's totally irrelevant. It's just totally like a moot point. Why should I not talk about something that doesn't exist?
Well, I'm calling in on a blue box through 7 loops by satellite.
No, you're not. You're just kidding. You know how I can tell?
No.
I can tell because I can tell from the microwave. Because
you're the fucking captain.
That's right. Careful.
Oh, and, eyes, okay, dude. What? Just one quick
oh,
thing.
Oh, come on, Chris Tompkinson.
Why doesn't snowplow rhyme? Snowplow.
Let somebody else call in.
Snowplow.
Chris Tompkinson, we've gone through, we've gone over this before.
You need
to quit calling the show.
They're spelled the same. You don't get.
I'm sorry, Captain Crunch. That's actually a common caller we have on our show.
I see. Well, no.
And
no.
He's a bit of a troublemaker. I was giving him a chance, though. Okay, I have somebody calling here as well.
On the phone?
Yeah. Oh, on the on Skype.
Okay.
Caller?
You're oh, my God. Here. Okay, let me pause my radio.
Oh, my goodness.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, caller. What is your name? Okay.
My name is Chris.
Okay.
I'm not going to say my last name.
Okay.
And, okay. Because
you don't have to. You can call yourself
Santa
Claus. You
can call me C-Bucks or C-Money.
Okay. What is your question, C-Bucks?
Okay, so I wanted to know if you talk to the Steves anymore.
Okay. Yeah, I talked to Steve Waz quite a few times. I had a need to call him last week to ask him a question about the Mac and some new Macs that were coming out and whether or not they had certain things on it. He didn't know because he was kind of out of the loop there. As far as Steve Jobs goes, I don't believe that Steve Jobs will ever want to talk to me again.
Oh.
Why? What happened?
I don't think that that I rate enough clout to deserve his attention because he's so rich and famous. And besides that, right now he's on his medical sabbatical, and he has his own problems to deal with right now.
Yeah, see, I was going
to
ask.
So I have to respect that, too. So even before his medical leave, I'm sure that he would have a lot more important people to talk to than me.
Yeah, see, I was going to ask if Steve Jobs was a douchebag, and, you know, kind of answers.
I'm not going to say that he's a douchebag, it's just that I haven't talked to him.
Yeah, don't be so down on yourself.
I don't know. I don't trust that Jobs. I don't trust him.
Do you have any other questions, Steve?
I was hiding in that turtleneck.
Yeah, that's his classic trademark, his turtleneck.
Thanks for the call, Seba.
Hey, I didn't say I was done.
Ah, you can call one more. You can ask. Actually, I have another caller calling.
Well, can I just listen? Oh, just,
yes.
And I'm not here. Okay. I'm not here.
All right. Hello, caller.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead with your question. We're with Captain Crunch.
And see money.
Yeah. Hey, man, I met you at DEF CON, dude. I give you that big old hug and broke your back. You fucking rock! I worship you, man!
All right, that obviously...
Obviously, he didn't want to stay on long, because if he did, the first question I was going to ask him was how to contact him.
Right, because he owes you
so
a bunch
my
of
attorneys,
money.
Yeah, so my attorneys will contact him.
Well, I have a question that comes from, actually, a guy that goes by Tombstone. He can't call in, but he's...
give him your phone number, whatever you do.
Yeah, he said, over the years, did you experiment with cellular phones? What is your prediction for the future? Will it be harder to freak, or will there be new ways to freak if the old ways die out? So basically, he's asking, what does this new technology mean for freaking?
Okay.
And if you've
experimented. Right. Now, when you get into new technology here, this is probably going to be where you're going to leave me, because let me explain. Cell phones came out in the very early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
I got experience with a cell phone, I think it was in 1980-81. I went and visited somebody in Chicago who had a cell phone in his car. And he actually had a BBS system hooked up to his car, a computer with an inverter. He was the only mobile BBS system.
Oh, wow.
He worked for a cellular phone company, so he doesn't have to worry about minutes. And that was the first ever exposure I had to a cell phone. Now, in 1980 was when I stopped blue boxing. I actually stopped blue boxing actually in 1978. It was the last blue box call I ever made.
Why is that?
Well, it was really risky, and in 1979 I started Captain Software, and then I had to go to the work furlough program. That was where I had did my work, you know.
Oh.
So it was right around the work furlough program that before the work furlough program I might have made one or two, but back then more and more systems were blocking blue boxes. In other words, it was not possible to whistle it off anymore because they were all going to go to CCIS CCIS out-of-band signaling. And I'd say 80% of the network was already out-of-band by the time I stopped, and I felt that by doing it anymore would be a great risk to me. And so I just stopped doing it at that point.
I see. Well,
but, okay, that was in 1979, 1980. Then cell phones came out.
Mm-hmm.
I never had a cell phone, so I really didn't have a way of making cell phones. They were very expensive at the time. My first cell phone was a cell phone in my car. Portable, pocket-sized cell phones were not available at the time. The only cell phone that was available was what they called the brick. It was a Motorola brick, and that was the first portable cell phone I've seen, and those things are... Oh, more than $1,000, and a contract on these suckers were $250 a month.
Whoa.
So it was not really feasible or cost-effective for me to have or own a brick. So since I didn't own a phone, I had no desire to try to hack it because there's no opportunity to do so.
Right.
Nor did I know of any hacker who actually worked on the cellular network who could give me enough information to where I could use to really hack the system. And then later on, they started cloning phones, and they had a code for the phones and how to clone the phones, and there was all these different ways and do it, and each phone had its own way of going in and changing the ID of the phone. So it was, and by that time I just lost interest. I mean, I wasn't interested in freaking after 1980.
Oh, okay. So you pretty much, 1980 was pretty much the end of freaking for you.
Yeah, because I was working with Easy Rider. I was very busy with making money on Easy Rider and developing it and developing the IBM PC version of it. And so I was very busy, so I didn't have much time. In fact, there was a time during the time I was working on the Easy Rider when I was not at the work furlough program, I'd go to sleep every other night.
So
I was pulling all-nighter every other night.
Oh, wow.
Thank you, Steve-Bucks, for calling in.
No,
yeah.
Thanks. I have a, so pretty much you haven't experimented with the cellular technology that much.
No, I met and talked with a bunch of people who kind of used to work for, had a few people who worked for the system.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't that familiar with it, although I could get technical journals on it. I had access to the technical journals on it about how it worked and, you know, how it all worked and all that, you know, manuals and stuff. Not on the cell phones themselves, but descriptions on how the cellular network worked in general.
Okay.
Without that, you can't do anything.
There's
a lot of fundamental written stuff about that.
Okay.
And it's not readily available to you. You have to get it. You have to get it through, you know, all kinds of nefarious sources.
I see. Now somebody asked me a question in the chat room. Sigflup asked me a question, but I don't see it anymore. So, if somebody remembers that, or I don't think Sigflup is in the chat room anymore.
You can't scroll up or something.
Yeah, I can't seem to find it. So if anybody can see that, just go ahead and copy and paste that for me. From the chat room, Gunner is asking, do you have any... Oh, wait, somebody's calling. Hold on a second. Caller, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. I want to know, Mr. Crunch, if you've ever done any mad hacks in Canada.
Mad hacks in Canada. Now, I went to Canada back during the early days when Vancouver...
Hey, this is Sigflub.
Oh, hold on a second, Sigflub. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Captain.
I went to Canada very early on in my days of blue boxing. And just before going into Canada, I ran across a... It's called Blaine, Washington. It's the last city you go to before crossing the border into Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And Blaine, Washington, they had the most strangest phone system ever. But once I got into Canada, my biggest problem was there were no 800 numbers in Canada. But I could call 555-1212 numbers and blow them off and make a call using a blue box in Canada. It was the same system as the North American system. Mm. And that was pretty much the extent of my Canadian freaking, other than, of course, getting into the 604 trunk and single frequencing. Because back before they upgraded their 604 area code exchange, they had an old step exchange in there. And you could dial all. That was where the famous 2111 conference was. They had a bunch of test codes. And once you dropped into that special trunk, you had the single frequency 01 that would drop you into another trunk. And then you had the single frequency, the number you wanted to call. And that was how we got into it, through mostly that. So once you dropped into the trunk, you could then dial 21111 and get into a conference. There was no limit to how many people you could get on. It was limited only by the number of trunk lines going into Canada.
Oh.
They had another interesting number, 1121 or 1211. I'm not sure which it was. And it would say a little recording that says 5 cents, ding, 10 cents, ding, ding, quarter, gong. And it's basically an operator's training tape. So operators would understand the recognition of the signals going into the phone when you made calls from payphones. And I thought that was pretty funny.
Well,
there were all kinds of other test numbers in there, too. They had a lot of really useful features.
I remember reading that in the Esquire article. If anybody wants to look that up online, I think it's linked on your website, Captain Crunch.
Yeah, I think there's a link to the web.
Okay.
I have one more question.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Why don't bead and head rhyme?
Thank you. Thank you, Samantha.
My name is Christine.
Christine. I'm sorry.
Christine Tompkinson.
Thank you. Thanks
Bye-bye.
For the questions. All right, Sigflug.
Come on, you guys. Please be a little more serious with your questions. My time here is limited.
Do you
here that really want to ask questions?
I'm sorry. If you need to go, just let us know.
No, I'm okay. My friend hasn't arrived yet. Even if he does, I can continue on for a few more minutes, so we're cool.
Okay, just let us know if you need a break or anything.
Yeah,
we
we're
have
cool.
only 30 minutes left.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead, Sigfug.
Okay, so my question was how you were introduced to the ARPANET and how you originally got onto it.
Oh, that's an interesting question. I've never had that question before, but let me answer it. I ran across this online service from Ann Arbor, Michigan called MNET. It was a BBS system running PicoSpan. And they had Usenet. Okay, so I was able to send a message to ihnp4.att.apple, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Through that news group. And that was how I was able to get on. They had dot commands instead of at commands for email addresses.
Okay.
All right. And from there, then I ran across another service which had the same PicoSpan, which was a local call for me, and a much better and bigger and more powerful system called the WELL. WELL stands for Whole Earth Electronic Link, WELL.com. They still exist today. And I got an account on the WELL. In fact, that was very interesting now that you mention it. I got kicked off the WELL because some dickhead subscribed me to more than 6,000 mailing lists. And back then, the mailing lists, the major domos of these mailing lists would not verify who it was that they would not verify that this was a subscription request.
And you,
so they would just accept the request outright without giving you an opportunity to cancel out of it. So I started getting zillions and zillions of messages that was clogging up my mailbox in the WELL, running humongous amounts of storage that I had to pay for.
Wow.
So I got into a fallout with the WELL, and they said, I can't pay that. I said, it wasn't my fault somebody subscribed me to all these mailing lists. Why should I have to pay for storage? Why can't you deny the bill or cancel the bill out, because why should I pay it? I got into that kind of a thing with me. And I had a free account with them anyway. The only thing is I had to pay for storage.
Mm. I'm glad we have Gmail now.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And unsubscribing.
Yeah, right. Oh, well, here's the thing about that. You can't subscribe another person to a mailing list, because what happens is the majordomo will mail back a confirmation message saying that you've just now subscribed to a mailing list. Do you accept this subscription? And you will have to say yes or no. So they fixed that pretty darn quick.
That's good.
Because they subscribed to whitehouse.gov to many, many mailing lists as well.
Ah.
Now that caused a bit of a problem.
So the government has an issue, they'll resolve it.
Well, actually, the Secret Service contacted me to ask me about this, whether I knew anything about it. I said, yeah, because they saw me on there as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so they contacted me, because it was a message that I found in all those zillions of messages. How I found it, I don't know. And I told him, yeah, I'm also having a problem. What can I do for you?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, keep track of all these messages coming in and let us know if there's any more coming in. And I said, yeah, sure, no problem. And he said they would try to put a stop to it. I don't know whether they did or not.
Oh.
I changed my email address, and that fixed that problem.
Yeah. Do you have any additional questions for him?
No, not really. I would probably be a little bit curious as to what sort of modems you're using at the time. Were you using a teletype or what you're actually using to connect?
I was using a DC Hayes compatible 2400 baud modem.
Okay. All right, well, thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, and I believe MNET, .ARPANET, is still around.
Wow, that's really amazing. Do you know who runs it now?
No, I don't know who runs it. I know I have an account on there that's probably been canceled for some time. I have no idea.
I wonder if my account still exists.
All right, well, thank you.
Thanks a lot for listening.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And we have another caller on the line. Go ahead with your question.
I was going to ask, do you think you've always been kind of attracted to counterculture or kind of breaking the rules that exist? Or do you think it's just out of your curiosity by exploring things you ended up kind of breaking rules and running into the law, stuff like that?
I think it was pretty much both. I mean, I've always been somewhat attracted by the counterculture. I got discharged out of the Air Force in 1968, right about the time Woodstock came out. Woodstock inspired me to get to know a lot of these hippie freaky people, which I found pretty interesting people. They seemed to be very smart, even though they probably did drugs and turned me on to smoking pot and all that stuff. But heck, you know, these people did have regular jobs, and some of them, of course, were feral people, but most of the time they were reasonably law-abiding as citizens, but they were just not. They would, of course, smoke pot, and they thought that should be legalized anyway, so.
And, you know, the pot probably.
And then I went to rainbow gatherings and stuff like that, you know.
But I mean, do you think that you ran into the law because of curiosity, that you were just going along, or?
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, curiosity was definitely a major part of it. Curiosity and my inability to tell, to detect a snitch, basically.
Okay.
Oh, then I have one other question. So along the way, I guess playing with phones or anything, did you run into any interesting pranks? Like basically just messing with people, getting them to do stuff?
Oh, yeah.
Do you have any stories about that?
Yeah.
Just kind of a funny one.
Real quick, yeah. There was a conference call, and some people were being really, really belligerent, and they were really being an asshole. And so... But I said, look, I know your phone number, so let me call you. So what I did was I duped them into calling me on the phone. I mean, I duped them into letting me have one of their numbers. So I got their number, then I called them up. I called them up on a special holding tandem. This was a trunk line that I could use to call them up on, that when they hang up, I would hold their line indefinitely. Until I hung up, their phone. All they did was pick up the phone. They wouldn't get a dial tone. They would get me. So I held their line for several hours.
So did people call the line, or was it?
Well, their line was dead. They couldn't use their phone. They had to go use another phone.
Oh, so I see. So when people called, they got a busy signal when the person...
No. They were already on the conference on another line. But I got one of their phone lines, and I held their phone line so they couldn't do anything with it.
Ah, I see. So every time they tried, you were just sitting there.
There was other instances where I did a phone trace on the network. I actually traced their phone line, social engineering the switchboards along the way.
Oh, okay.
So I went through and I told them that we had a trace. I didn't mention who it was for. I said this was a special law enforcement trace, yada, 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 and bullshit of them, but I was a special detective from some bodunk police department that they couldn't check up on very easily, so...
Everyone's scared to do that.
Well, back then, during the time that I was around, it was easy to do, because you could easily make pretend you're some bodunk police department from Grasshopper Junction, Arizona. That was always my... And I said, this is a sheriff's department in Grasshopper Junction, Arizona. And it had a payphone, a restaurant, a gas station. And it was called Grasshopper Junction, Arizona. And that was the city that I had. And I says, okay, what's your phone number? So, you know, they always want to call you back. So I had a loop around number in Grasshopper Exchange, and then I used that as the phone number to call, and they'd call me to verify that I was the police department. I said, yeah, Detective Jones here, may I help you? He says, yeah, we want to just verify about this trace you want to run. Yeah, please, go ahead and run it. And if you want, you can call me back when you got the trace completed. I'll be here at this number anytime, so call me back. And I just sat away, and I waited for the loop round call to come through. It come through about 10, 15 minutes later, and I got the guy's phone number, and then I sat on the... And then it was during the time that he was talking on the chat line. I says, hey, by the way, Mr. Jackass, Prick, whoever you are, I know your phone number. He said, no, you don't. Oh, yeah? It's, and I read off his phone number. He kind of got freaked out.
It's like, how did you know?
Well, yeah, there are ways to do that now, but it's tricky.
What I find amazing is that there's so many things you can do with the phone, even today, where people think it's magic or they don't know how you did it. I always find those things very interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Just like last week, I was talking to a guy, and he thought three-way calling was magic. He goes, this is some hacker shit. You've got two people on the line.
Well, Mitnick's new book is supposed to come out pretty soon. It's going to have a lot of interesting stuff in it, I'm told.
By who? No,
Kevin Mitnick. You know Kevin Mitnick, don't you?
Yeah.
Well, guess what? Just a few days ago, I met him in person in Las Vegas at the special private geek party.
Ah.
Put on by a person whose pseudonym is Vampire Killer.
Oh, okay.
That's all I got to say. It was a special private geek / elite party where a lot of people were flown in from all over the country, and I was one of the lucky ones that got into this party.
That's pretty cool. Had you met him before, or?
Actually, no. I had not met him before. I had met him only a couple of days before. And he says, come on down to my Tuesday party.
Oh.
And I says, yeah, I had to cancel a lot of stuff. I had therapy I had to catch up on. I had a doctor's appointment. Because a lot of my time is being spent in physical therapy. I go 3 days a week, and it's always a hassle that I have to do it, but I got to do it in order to heal myself.
Oh, yeah. How long do you think it'll take for you to heal?
They said somewhere between 6 and 8 months.
Wow. You know what?
And there would be some instances where I wouldn't have the use of certain nerves in my hand.
Well, some people in IRC, they didn't know about the story about how it happened, and everyone was saying...
All they have to do is go up to my website, JD Crunchman on Facebook, facebook.com/JD Crunchman. Go up to my wall, go up to my status and read my wall and go back as far as Facebook will let you go and just read up on what I did, because everything I did was up on Facebook and on Twitter. If there was something important that I put up on Facebook, then I would tweet and say, hey, go over to my Facebook page and check this out. And I gave a tiny URL. They just click on that, and they go right directly to Facebook, and there it is.
I see. Well, what I was going to say is they actually want to find the guy. Is that what they're saying?
Yeah.
So, but everyone's
well,
really...
Well, unless that guy wants to come out of the woodwork and admit to doing it and is willing to pay me more than $12,000, because that's how much it costs for me to get this therapy done so far.
Wow.
Almost all of the money that I raised up is being used. In fact, I might even be quite a bit short. I cut it off at 10, but two more 2,000 came in before I had to cut it off. I says, okay, that's enough, guys.
Yeah.
So I says, okay, I don't need any more. I don't want to take any more of your money.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that was really nice of everyone to do that for you. That was really important surgery.
Oh, I know. It was really amazing that they. I raised all the money in 10 days, 12 days.
Ooh.
Most of the people who responded were from Italy.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Somebody from Italy had put it out on a TV program.
Mm-hmm.
Then they started contacting me on Facebook and Twitter, because that was where I was on.
Ah.
They gave out my Facebook page, and I started getting all these friend requests from Facebook.
Yeah.
They were all coming from Italy.
Wow. That's
Italy
amazing.
And also from, let's see, who else? Quite a few from Germany, quite a few from France.
Well,
And also, I think, not that many from Asia, because I don't think Asia has Facebook yet.
Some places are having trouble
getting that.
Well, we have a caller on the line. Do you have a question for Captain Crunch?
More just a statement.
Who am I talking
thank
to?
You. This is Matt Hillock. I'm on your Facebook.
Okay. You
know. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I've seen you. I think I friended you on Facebook. Is that your picture in the middle of the screen here?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess I think I've seen you before. At least I've seen your picture before on Facebook. Because, you know, when people friend me on Facebook, I do read a lot about, I mean, I go up to their pages. I read their pages. And if their wall is accessible, I can read their wall. But I get a very good idea by looking at their pictures whether or not I want to friend them or not. And then when I friend them, I go to their wall and I look at their wall and I say, oh, this guy's an interesting guy. So, and then first thing I do is I post to their wall and I usually try to promote myself. I mean, I'm very selfish.
Yeah, it's marketing.
Right, and I would plug, of course, this Hack This movie. Hack This movie, I'd plug that and plug my, of course, back then during my, my raising money for my operation, I would plug the operation, but.
Yeah.
You know, I says, hey, come on, donate today. Go to Saving Captain Crunch and donate some money, you know.
Thank you for the interview. I know you're almost out of time. I just wanted to thank you for doing this.
I'm going to be here as long as you'll have me or until my friend arrives. Whichever comes first.
Do you have any interesting questions or anything that you want him to talk about in particular?
It's basically just a thanks.
Aw.
Yeah. Okay, it's just a big hug, but not bad enough to hurt your neck.
Yeah, that's... not, you know, like, people come up to me and they try to shake my hand, I try to, like, cringe away, you know, because it hurts me. Somebody would shake my hand and just a normal pressure, oh, that's very painful. Yeah.
I know, I have a guy...
I can't even put on my backpack. I can't even put my backpack on without help, so that's how bad off I am.
I can't believe that one guy did so much damage.
Yeah, well, boy, that guy comes out of the... If I ever find out who this guy is, they're going to shoot me here from my attorneys.
Well, thank you for calling in, Matt.
Cool. Y'all take it easy.
Thanks.
It was nice talking to you. Bye.
We still have C-Bucks on the line. He's going to ask another question.
Go ahead.
Hello.
Hello. Yeah.
Hello?
Are you doing overall?
Health-wise, I'm still...
I want you to start living as a gay woman. And I want you to start a gay relationship.
This is not C-Bucks.
Yes.
I think that was a fake one.
Let's try to keep these questions really focused toward hacking, guys, because you're just waste... All you're doing when you ask a question, when you're asking those kinds of questions, you're just taking away the time from somebody that's got a legitimate question. So let's kind of cool with you people, please.
And I wanted to ask you about your hobbies. If anyone else wants to call in, the number's 484-240-4050, maybe one or two more callers. But what kind of hobbies do you do?
I don't have any really specific major hobbies right now because a lot of my time, of course, is being spent on my healing and working on ideas. So I guess my biggest hobby is hatching good ideas and trying to see them take place and hopefully making these ideas be useful for not just me but for a lot of other people. There's going to be some situations in the next couple of years where it's not going to be the same, folks. Mm. It's going to be different. And you got to prepare for that. And people are not preparing for that. A lot of my ideas are getting towards that. I don't know. I have no idea what I'm going to do if all this stuff breaks down.
Do you have a website where you list all these things, or do you think you should start a blog?
I have a blog already, and it's called crunchcreations.com. So go up to the blog and read that. Crunchcreations.com. I talk about alternative energy. I talk about capacitor batteries. I talk about some new Tesla wireless transmission systems that were recently released from a book on Tesla. It's called The Wheels, Harnessing the Wheels of Nature. It's an amazing book. It's a fascinating book. It's got all of Tesla's most recent patents and ideas that were just recently released from the government, and they're all really fascinating. You should read it. The diagrams they're using are not really of this time period, but I think you can figure it out.
That's some really interesting stuff.
Okay, more questions. Let's get these questions.
I think, I don't know if nobody else is really calling in.
Well, there's nobody around calling questions, so I guess that's...
Yeah. We do have 32 listeners. That was the total number of listeners.
Well, that's how many people are listening right now. So if anyone...
What's the capacity of your radio station? How many can you have total listening to it?
Actually, I'm not sure, but usually during a show, it's around 30. But we record it and we play it. So it's also going to be available on...
I also want to talk to you how you were able to patch the Skype into the radio. Did you use a special program for that?
Well, what I'm doing is I have a program that broadcasts my my voice, I guess. Okay. Basically, it broadcasts anything that goes through my computer.
So basically, what you're doing then is you have your microphone.
Uh-huh.
You patching your Skype through your microphone, and then the output goes to the station.
Well, it's a stream, it's an internet stream.
You're streaming from your microphone.
I have a program that I use that streams whatever comes out of my computer. So if I play a song, I put the song into the program, but I can also play files on my computer.
Or whatever.
Or they can hear Skype or whatever. My microphone actually,
How are you able to take the sound coming in from your listeners? And then, it doesn't matter because Skype does that.
Right, Skype. I can hear everything.
It's just a conference call on Skype. Duh.
Right.
God, where'd my head go lately?
Oh, it's okay. It's okay.
Well, I've got somebody calling in here. Who
caller,
we got?
Do you have a question?
Oh, hey, this is Vic Nichols, ETA man. I just want to say it's really freaking awesome that you got John Draper on Cacti Radio.
Yeah.
Dude, you're legendary.
I'm honored.
I am honored. Wow, I'm actually talking to Captain Crunch.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you can talk to me anytime you want. You know, I'm always on chat. I'm always JD Crunchman. Just don't call me on Skype, okay, because I don't accept Skype calls unless they're coming in from any of my donors. And the only okay. If you're a donor to my mom, I want to say this. If you were a donor or even now a donor to Saving Captain Crunch, get on my donors list. All you have to do is go up to Saving Captain Crunch, click on a private conversation with Crunch, and book your time with me. And you can talk to me face-to-face on Skype, only if you are a donor.
Okay. Brad, RBCP just told me the capacity for the radio stream is 50.
Ah, so.
So 50
are you getting
people
this,
can listen.
Are you getting this from a service?
I believe he buys he pays for the stream.
So you can pay for so many streams, so many streaming channels.
He can stream 24 hours.
Oh, I know that, but the amount of people that can stream or watch, you know, that can stream too varies, and all you have to do is just if you want to pay more, you can get more, right? That's basically how it works.
Yeah, I think
it's like 1,500 or something or 1,000. I don't know. You can choose 500 users, 1,000, depending on how many you have.
And how much would you have? How much would you have to pay for like 1,000 listeners?
I don't know. There's different services. You just go online and look for streaming. You can actually run it yourself off of any server, which is cheaper if you have a server anywhere. You can.
Well, yeah, if you got to have the bandwidth, you know.
We have a lot of space on Cacti Radio, so if you ever want to do a show. Just let me know, and I'll ask RBCP if we can have that time slot, and we can talk about, you know, whatever you want. Because I know you have a lot to say about the whole future type
what
stuff.
What about GNNR? Is that GNNR just called in? Gunner?
Oh, yes, this is Gunner. He called in, but I couldn't answer, so I called him back. Did you have anything to say, Gunner?
Oh, so you were saying you worked at KKUP?
Yeah, KCUP. Cupertino.
What is your
91.5.
Because I'm in the Bay Area as well, so I know a lot of the stuff, like, you were talking about the Homebrew Computer Club. Obviously, I'm a lot younger, but,
I don't know whether you remember those days or not, because they were back in days that you were not even born, probably, but I can say this, that KCUP was on 91.5 out of Cupertino. They had their transmitter up on a mountaintop behind Saratoga, up in the hills somewhere. They had a pretty good range. They were heard mostly in Santa Cruz and Monterey, much, much better than in San Jose. The closer you are to the Saratoga, the harder it is for you to pick up the signal. So if you're out in San Jose, in the eastern part of San Jose, you probably pick it up pretty good. It's on 91.5, which is next to quite a few other strong stations. So you might have trouble picking it up, but it's certainly listenable throughout all of San Jose and mostly the Bay Area.
I was just wondering if you did music for the radio station, or were you doing
Yeah, I played a lot of underground music. A lot of the stuff I played was not broadcast on normal radio. I would play songs from Heavy Guns. I would play songs and stuff from a lot of these off-the-wall bands, but a lot of them were local bands, actually. We were able to get the records, and there was one or two people that worked at K-Cup who got... Who basically supplied the station with the records, and they had contacts with record companies and record distributors. They were able to get records, so they would listen to the records and they would deem it. And if it was something that was not being played on PSJ or on the other stations, then they would play it. But KKUP in itself was not just a rock station; it was a station that played a large variety of music. My show from 6 to 9 p.m. on Saturday nights was pretty much progressive and underground rock. And then the Art at Play came on after me and went from 9 until midnight. He would play a lot of esoteric stuff. He would have a thing called the Weekend News, the WEAKENDGNUZ, as spelled on a K-Cup program guide.
Oh, yeah, one other random question. Do you go to Burning Man now? I think I saw some pictures.
Yeah, I've been to Burning Man quite a few times. Well, it's great if you're fit enough to deal with it. I'm not. I have to be careful. I can't go right now. I mean, I'm not going to go unless I get on a bicycle and ride it without fucking myself up. But, you know, like I said, I have to be really careful.
Yeah, and you don't know who you're going to run into, who might give you another hug or something.
Oh, I don't care about that. Burning Man is not about that. Burning Man is about a bunch of naked people running around in the desert doing anything they want.
But, I mean, as far as public, you know, public events go, I don't know. I guess you can't live in fear.
I have no problem with Burning Man. Trust me.
Yeah.
Burning Man, it's something that I always look. Next year, if I can find somebody who has an RV... that wants to offer me a space in their RV, I will go. I will go only if I can get an RV and get an incumbent bicycle that I can ride. I will probably go.
Well, maybe next year, because I think it's already...
Well, tickets are already on sale, and they're already up to $250, so what can I say?
All right, well, Gunnar, did you have anything else that you wanted to say? Gunner.
Hello, Gunner, are you there?
Yeah,
thanks a lot. It was good to talk to you and everything. I don't have any more questions. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you, Gunner. If anyone else wants to call, it's 484-240-4050. We have Madhouse Live coming up with RBCP, but he is running behind, so we'll answer calls until he gets here. Do you have to go, Captain Crunch?
I have no plans. Keep me going as long as you like.
Okay. All right. Let's see. So you're working on what is Hack This Movie? I never went to see what.
Oh,
that
you
was.
Gotta go check that out. HackThisMovie.com. It's a collection of a lot of interviews from some of the more famous persons that I've met. Interviews with Steve Wozniak and I think are in there also. There's also a lot of interviews with other people that I met that are really, really interesting people. Some stuff that I'm doing, B-roll, and stuff with me doing cool things. And all that, and a lot of the stuff that's going to come up, and there's going to be new stuff on there too. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to raise money to complete it, and that's why when you go to Hack This Movie, there's a donate button there. So click on that donate button, donate some cash flow, folks, so we can get the thing completed. We have at least another hour and a half of good video that just needs to be edited and narrated and reviewed. And, you know, because you can see video of stuff. If you don't know what it is, you can't narrate it, right?
Right.
You're going to watch that and see how there's these people doing whatever they're doing. They're not going to know that, hey, that this guy is a, they might know me, mm-hmm. sure, by recognizing me, but they might not know who I'm talking to.
Right.
So I have to announce who I'm talking to in case that's the case. So the narrator has to do all that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Putting music between each of the different pieces. The music's got to be, we've got to get the rights to the music and all that stuff. So the music on the Hack This movie also has to be, you know, clean and clear legally. We can't put music on there we don't know or have rights to use. So we're careful. So we want to put music with it and all that. And there's a lot of music that I could do. But I can't mm-hmm. do it because I don't have access to Ableton Live because I can't afford to get it. That's what this money's for. It's money so we can go out and buy the stuff we need to put the music to the thing. And I am so looking forward to the time when I can make music. I've actually made a song. Mm-hmm. I have this friend. His name is James Stepman. He invited me over to his house one weekend. And he knows Ableton Live really well. And we hacked out a trance song in a 6-minute trance song over a weekend. And I did the arrangement, and he helped me. He helped me because I didn't know how to use the program. He says, okay, how do I do this? He says, so you do it this way. I says, okay, cool. I want to do it right there. I want to put this sequence of music here. I want to put this there. And I just, you know, all it is, you're making music with Ableton Live is you're putting certain bleeps and songs in the right places. So mm-hmm. and so I did that. So I found all these different sounds. He's got a huge collection of sounds. So I pulled off these sounds off his library of sounds, and I just put them together into a trance song, into a beat. He's got the beat. He's got the melody. It's melody on the keyboard a little bit, and put it together. I mean, the sequence was simple. It's like three keys. That's all I had to play over and over again.
but you've got about an hour and a half of a movie that you need to finalize.
Exactly, and that's what we need to raise money to complete that. I mean, video editors cost a lot of money. I mean, I can get really good rates, for use of video editing. Carl's been doing most of the video editing.
I'd really, really like to see that movie, and I can't wait.
Well, you can go up to hackthismovie.com and see a trailer right now.
Ah, okay.
And what we got done is up there.
Okay.
So go watch that, and then after you watch that, then just imagine what else we can add to it. You know, we got titling to do, we got music to do, we got a lot of stuff to do to make feel a movie, you know?
There's a lot of things that go into a movie that people just think are just magic.
I live right here where they're all made. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I mean, within 3 kilometers, there's 6 movie studios right next to me. I'm a few mm-hmm. blocks away from Warner Brothers. I'm a hop, skip, and a jump from Disney. I walk by Disney on the way to my therapy, the Walt Disney mm-hmm. Company, right there on Alameda Avenue, right next to NBC, you know.
Yeah.
So I live in that area, and I'm just walking by NBC, the old NBC mm-hmm. building, which, by the way, is no longer there. It's pretty much vacant. They took NBC and they moved it over to Universal because Universal bought NBC. And they moved them over to the Universal City Studios, and that's where all their stuff's over there now. Jay Leno did his program over there. When Jay Leno left NBC, and before he left NBC, I could see him from my window, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty crazy.
Well, I had one more question. Actually, I have a really bad memory, so I kind of forgot it already. I was going to ask you, what precautions did you take when you were freaking, besides the whole making sure you could get away quickly? You know, what were some of the precautions you took? Because you...
Very simple. Being invisible. Not attracting attention. Don't attract attention. That is the key. Don't attract attention. So I thought of all the different ways that I could attract attention. If I'm on the phone system and I'm whistling 2600 and blowing a connection off,
mm-hmm.
there's a flash, there's a wink. That wink is observed by an operator if I had the operator place the call. That was impossible to mask. In that case, I had to think of an alibi to talk to the operator to say, hey, this is a data call. There are other times when you make calls that you get a reorder or disconnect. If I were to make a call with a blue box and it's not tuned properly, and I go into a we're sorry, your call cannot be completed recording, that is attracting attention. Because normally that would never happen.
So you hurry up and leave.
Not necessarily hurry up and leave, because if I hung up on that trunk and go make another call, then that trunk is operated by the tandem that I went through. Let's say Phoenix or L.A. or something like that. And so if I went through that trunk, then don't make a call through L.A. I have many different ways that I can make calls through. So if I did get a reorder, what I wouldn't do is I wouldn't try to make the same call twice. Well, I would make the same call twice. Maybe I would try it three times right away in succession because I want to try to get this blue box to work. And in fact, that's one of the reasons how Waz's blue box got caught. One of these persons that got one of he bought one of Waz's blue boxes. He was a friend of mine. And he used it from home. It was not tuned. It was tuned absolutely perfect. The frequencies were absolutely within tolerance. The problem was the waveform. The waveform was not readily detected by the system that you're doing. There was a lot of harmonics, a lot of subharmonics, and the equipment detected that and said, "Well, we can't have subharmonics in these tones. They could be not recognized. They would drop the call or drop a trouble card."
Oh, okay.
So if you made a call on a blue box call and you blew it off, chink, and you could key pulse area code and number start. Here, bleep. We're sorry, your call did not complete it as dialed. More than likely, it is a problem with the tones in the blue box. It could be any number of reasons. Number one, the tones are not in tolerance. Number two, the amplitudes of the tones were not in tolerance. Number three, the tones were not pure enough to be passed through the filters. There's many different reasons why the equipment would fail your call. If you went to that blue box and made that call, you would attract attention if you kept trying to make your call.
Mm-hmm.
So the rule of the game was no more than three times per tandem, and we followed that rule, and we never got caught. At least nobody got caught and did that. Followed that rule.
I see. Okay, so did you have to, when you were on conferences or when you were talking to
and
people?
And also when I was on conferences, there's another thing you had to be worried about in attracting attention is on conferences.
Yeah.
A lot of the times these conferences got started and set up by phone freaks calling the switching office of old step exchanges and asking them to bend the sleeve of the connection. And when you do that, there's no DC current going into the line when you make the call. So you call the ring it, and it rings and it goes into the recording. We're sorry, your call cannot be completed as done. That recording is not coming from the tandem itself. The recording is calling from the local exchange. And the local exchange sees that recording, but you're still connected to that number. You're just getting that recording. So if you called yourself, you called your same number on a different phone, you can knock yourself into the call. Once you knock yourself into the call and you got control of the conference call, anybody else can call into that same number sequenced up by one. So if I had the number starting ending in 12, then 13 would be a number, 14 would be a number, and you have to try to pick one of those numbers that wasn't busy. And when you got all that number, you would have to bump yourself into the conference by calling on a second phone line that same number to bump yourself in.
Okay.
Those were called bump-in conferences. Those were used during my day. A lot of other conferences are being put up specifically. Mark Brunet, Richard Cashton.
Oh, they still do them?
Set up conference calls, a kind of a conference call. But those conference calls were charged conference calls. But these bump-in conference calls were not charged because you wouldn't soup. They wouldn't go off hook. So you could sit on a conference call and not get, if you were on an ESS exchange, you'd probably get dropped off after 5 minutes.
Well, were you ever worried about somebody listening in and you had to just kind of warn someone or not warn them, but kind of have like a disclosure like, oh, this is for educational purposes only?
Not really.
No. You guys just talked freely or?
Yeah. We wouldn't say, well, who would we say that to, educational purposes only?
I don't know. I just...
I don't know if, you know, you had to, you know, make some sort of statement just in case somebody was listening.
We just assumed that they were listening.
Ah. Okay.
But we didn't care.
Okay.
Because we weren't breaking the law calling a conference number.
Yeah.
We weren't calling that number with the intention of making a free call. We were calling that number with the intention of establishing a conversation with one or more people.
Just sharing information.
Yeah, that's nothing. All I want.
Yeah. Well,
remember, there was no internet back then.
Yeah.
There were no BBSs back then. The only thing that you had were conference calls. Conference calls were like the IRCs of today.
Mm-hmm. I see. I think we do need to go. Madhouse Live is about to come on in a few minutes.
Sounds like a plan. Carry on with your programming for sure.
I'm so glad that you agreed to this.
And we might do this again depending on the response. If you get more response to other people that are listening to it over a period of time, and they call up and ask for another show, if I get enough responses, hey, I'd be willing to do another one.
That'd be great. If you have a particular topic that you want to talk about, we can cover that. I had to kind of shorten it this time.
Yeah, we cover that through email.
Or we can do a broadcast. I just want to thank everyone for listening, and I'm going to go ahead and put this up. You'll be able to download the recording on my Facebook page, and also there will be a link on omghacks.net. Thank you, Captain Crunch.
And thank you very much for having me.
Okay, well, you have a great night, and coming up next is Madhouse Live.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Hack Republic Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.